FM band is from 88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUP. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and it looks like they pick up CKUP, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUP is on the air.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. Today, we're turning the tables, and my colleague, Amanda Saadi, is going to be asking me questions about the Israeli elections.
Welcome, Deanna.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
Glad to turn the tables on you for a change.
So it's always fun. So thanks for doing this.
So Israel is holding its fifth election in 3 years. Can you give us a little breakdown on why exactly this is happening?
That's a great question, Amanda. The short answer is that these parties can't agree on passing legislation. The longer answer is that because the longest serving prime minister, who is Benjamin Netanyahu, has corruption charges against him, there's been an attempt to try to push him out of politics and make sure that he's not able to be the prime minister. And so there have been all of these disputes about these coalitions that are forming, primarily an anti-Netanyahu coalition. Now, to be clear, and this part is important, none of these disputes have anything to do with Palestinians. It's not as though any of the political parties, any of the Zionist political parties, are opposed to Netanyahu's actions against Palestinians. To the contrary, there is a wall of Israeli consensus when it comes to dealing with Palestinians. And that wall of consensus supports the illegal occupation. It's a wall of consensus that supports illegal construction of settlements. It's a consensus that supports annexation. It's a consensus that supports Israel demolishing Palestinian homes. It's a consensus that supports the blockade on the Gaza Strip. And it's a consensus that supports not having equal rights or equality for Palestinians in Israel. So all of this, this horse trading, so to speak, and the back and forth when it comes to elections really only center around whether Netanyahu is going to return and be prime minister, but has absolutely nothing to do with Palestinians, because all of the political parties, whether the fascist right that we've seen emerge, and actually grow, not emerge, grow to the so-called left. And again, this is a so-called left because this isn't a left or a progressive parties that that are progressive when it comes to Palestine. No, these are all, they're all right wing. Whether it's left or right, they all agree on all of these tenets of supporting the occupation, of building and expanding settlements, of demolishing Palestinian homes, of blockading the Gaza Strip, and on lack of equality for Palestinians in Israel. So that's what the election is not about.
So you mentioned that there is, you know, varying degrees of right-wing parties. The left is not really a left. So now we're seeing, you know, more blatantly racist and fascist politicians like Ben-Gvir. How much support do they have, and how worried should people be about them?
They have tons of support. And we should be worried. Now, I want to be clear as somebody who lives here. Ben-Gvir is not new. The Ben-Gvir style of politician is also not new. We've seen throughout virtually every single Israeli election that the way that Israeli politicians get votes is by showing how much they can beat up and bash Palestinians. We saw this with Lieberman when he came up back in 2009, when he said no citizenship without loyalty. We saw this with the emergence of Naftali Bennett, who said that this is a Jewish state, and who very openly and blatantly supported settlement construction, who was not shy in saying that he killed Palestinians. We saw this with the support of Ayala Shaked, who called Palestinian mothers snakes. We've seen this with Netanyahu, who's been very openly racist towards Palestinians. And now we see this with Ben-Gvir, who has made it clear that he supports ethnic cleansing. So while the Ben-Gvir style is not new, we should, of course, be worried about these people. And the reason that we should be worried is because along with this racist rhetoric is permission to be racist. And that was what Netanyahu in government did, was that every day as a Palestinian, he made sure that we were facing some form of daily racism, racism in his speech, racism in his behavior, and he normalized racism with the likes of Ben-Gvir. Now, Ben-Gvir, just so that people are aware, Ben-Gvir is an Israeli settler. He lives in Hebron, in the illegal settlement in Hebron. He's somebody who walks around with a weapon and has been routinely seen pulling out his weapon against Palestinians. He believes in the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah. He, in fact, opened up his parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. He's a person who supports the views of Meir Kahana, who says that he is his spiritual leader. And he's somebody who has indicated that Baruch Goldstein, a man who massacred 29 Palestinians back in 1994, he's dressed up as him and calls him his hero. So this is not just a person who is a racist, but racist fascist who believes in ethnic cleansing, and we should be worried. We should be worried because this type of behavior has become normalized. And if he makes it into the Knesset, which is now looking as though he will be the third largest party in the Knesset, it was more likely than not that he's going to get a cabinet position, which means that, again, Palestinians are going to be the target of his wrath. So I think people should be afraid because of who he is, because of the ideas that he supports, and because of the fact that that no country around the world has been willing to hold any of these politicians to account for their racist speech and for supporting these racist views.
So how will this exactly impact Palestinians, both in Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank? For someone like him to be elected, what could we expect to happen on the ground?
No matter who wins in these elections, the losers are Palestinians. And I say this because whether it's the right wing or what Israelis like to call center left, even though by any other standard, it's actually very right wing, whether the right wing or the what they call the center left gets elected, the outcome is going to be the same for Palestinians. The outcome is going to be that they will be pushing for the construction and expansion of Israeli settlements. They'll be pushing for more and more land theft. They'll be pushing for more and more assassinations. They'll be pushing for more and more home demolitions. They'll be pushing for a tightening, an even further tightening of the blockade on the Gaza Strip. And they're going to be pushing for even more racist legislation against Palestinians in Israel. So these elections are, no matter who wins, Palestinians are the losers. And that is fundamentally the problem, is that, again, nobody is ever holding these political parties to task for the electoral choices that they make. I'm going to contrast that, Amanda, with the 2006 Palestinian general elections. In 2006, the Palestinian general elections were held in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And as you know, this is only a small portion of Palestinians worldwide. And yet, even though we held those elections, which were free and fair and overseen by many, many, many people, including U.S. President Jimmy Carter, the result was when Hamas won a majority of the seats in the parliament, Hamas was boycotted. It was boycotted by the international community. And we still see that 16 years later, that it's not only boycotted, but that there is a no contact policy. The purported reason behind this no contact policy is because Hamas does not support the Oslo Accords. Now, I want you to contrast that with all of the parties that are in Israel, and in particular those that are in the right wing. We see that on the right wing, that whether it's Likud, which is the least of the right wing, onward, then none of them support the Oslo Accords. None of them have recognized Palestine or Palestine's right to exist. And none of them have renounced any form of violence or any form of terrorism against Palestinians. Now, take it to the even further right wing, such as the Ben-Gvirs and the Smotriches, the religious Zionist parties that are now emerging, will become the third largest parties. You see that none of them have any, believe that Palestinians should have any rights, and in fact, openly call for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And yet you see the way, the disparate way that Palestinian political parties are treated versus Israeli political parties, that Israeli political parties that are open in their calls for ethnic cleansing become normalized and are dealt with, whereas Palestinian political parties that all they're simply doing is saying that they don't support Oslo and that they believe that they have a right to resist, that these political parties are ostracized. And so you can see how easily this push to the right happens and how Palestinians are affected by this because of the fact that the world is not willing to stand up and hold Israel to account for anything.
So over the past month, probably longer, we've seen a rise in Palestinian resistance, specifically in Nablus and in Jenin. How do these elections tie into what's happening on the ground in the West Bank?
Well, they're connected and they're not connected. I think first it's important to keep in mind that Palestinians have a right to resist. And we've seen that since the start of this calendar year, that virtually every single day, Israel has killed one Palestinian. The number is staggering. It's the highest number in about a decade. And Israel keeps doing this in a low-grade fashion, low-grade, day by day, day by day. And because it's low-grade, day by day, although the impact is great, the world doesn't do anything about it. They don't say anything about it. Now, add to this the fact that as we're getting closer to the elections, Yair Lapid, who is running on a center-left ticket. Now, remember, when center-left is just a label that they use, but there's nothing centrist about him. There's nothing left-wing about him. In any other political context, this would be considered to be a right-wing political party. They're not progressive in any way, shape, or form. We've seen that in order for him to get more votes, that he has cracked down on Palestinians. And he's brought back this campaign of assassinations. Just last week, we saw that Israel assassinated six Palestinians in Nablus. We see that that Palestinian cities like Nablus and Jenin, as well as the Shafat refugee camp, were besieged for days. Nablus is still closed. Even leading up to this election, just on the eve of elections, Israel announced that it is closing down all of the checkpoints, which is to say that no Palestinian, including those who have the ability to travel because they have permits, no Palestinian is allowed outside of cities that are in the West Bank. And this is all for him to shore up to support and to show just how tough he is. It's also important to keep in mind that this labeling of the six NGOs, six Palestinian NGOs, and outlawing, banning these six NGOs also came under Lapid, under Lapid's leadership, meaning that this wasn't something that was done under Netanyahu, the self-professed right-winger, but somebody who claims that he is a center-leftist. So what these elections are doing is that he is trying to use Palestinian bodies to try to get more and more votes. And this is the tactic that each and every Palestinian political party has done, is they're always trying to show just how tough they are and who can hit harder, who can hit faster, who can hit further. In fact, going back to Ben-Gvir, one of the messages that he has been pushing is that this is now time for him to own the House. Now, when he says the word House, he's not talking about houses in the House of Congress or the Congressional House or the Parliamentary House. He's talking about physically owning the House. And so again, these elections are affecting what Israel is doing because each of the parties wants to demonstrate just how tough they are when it comes to Palestinians. None of them have been talking about ending their 55-year military occupation. None of them have been talking about ending settlements. None of them have been talking about decolonization. None of them have been talking about no longer stealing land. None of them have been talking about stopping home demolition. And none of them have been talking about equality for Palestinians.
So in a sense, these elections are just business as usual for them.
It is. For Israel, it's business as usual. And for Palestinians, of course, it's business as usual. But the scary part, Amanda, is that while it's business as usual for Israel and for what it does to Palestinians, what I suspect is going to happen is that we Palestinians are going to pay the price even harder this time. And I say this because if you look back in history at the time when Netanyahu was first elected, or sorry, when he was first ousted, not elected, when he was first elected, this was during the Clinton era. And then when it came time for re-election, he ended up losing and no longer being prime minister because of the rise of the Palestinian vote inside Israel. The Palestinian vote inside Israel is what actually brought him down back in the 90s. Since that time, he has put his sights on Palestinians and has done everything possible to try to make sure that the Palestinians pay the price. I suspect that when, and I'm not saying if, I said when he gets elected again, that he is going to do it once again. He's already said as much leading up to this election. He's already indicated that he's going to be building and expanding settlements, that he's going to push for annexation, that he's going to push for more countries to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. But he's also indicated that Palestinians in Israel are going to pay a price. And so even though this might be business as usual, we shouldn't be sitting contently and saying, oh, well, because it's business as usual, we're just going to have to wait and see. I think we should be alarmed by what is happening and be aware of what is happening and be prepared for what the next phase is going to bring for us.
And what can Palestinians do then in 48 in Israel and in the West Bank?
What we can do, Amanda, is recognize that no matter who is in Israeli politics, that these policies are going to be the same. And there seems to be a tendency on the part of some people to say that this is all about Netanyahu. It's not. This isn't just about Netanyahu. It's about the entire system. And I think that we need to be doing a lot more strategizing about how to try to stop this racist legislation, how to stop the settlement construction and expansion, how to protect ourselves from Israel's military machine, how to protect ourselves from our homes being demolished, and how to protect ourselves as a community.
Well, thank you, Deanna, for that breakdown, and we'll see what happens, yes, in the next few days.
Thank you, Amanda. Thanks. Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Buttu. Thanks for listening.
Israel's holding its fifth national election today in less than 4 years. The election could result in former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returning to power, even though he's currently on trial for corruption. The election comes at a time of an increasingly deadly Israeli crackdown on the occupied West Bank, where the Israeli military has been carrying out near-nightly raids. At least 125 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year, including dozens of children. Meanwhile, Amnesty International is calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel for committing possible war crimes in Gaza during its deadly assault in August. We go now to Jan Egeland. He is Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, joining us from Jerusalem. Jan, you've just returned from Gaza. Can you talk about the conclusion of your trip in both the occupied territories in West Bank and Gaza?
Yeah, I've been back now to Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, where I have traveled for 45 years. And I must say it's one of the bleakest visits I've had, in part because there is no peace process at all. There is no reconciliation between the two neighbors. And there is more settler violence against Palestinian civilians. There are more house demolitions of Palestinian homes, and there are more of our aid programs, aid projects, aid structures that are being demolished by the occupying power. I don't think people outside of this region really understands that we've had now 55 years of occupation, 15 years on the siege of Gaza, where Gazans, 2 million of them, half of them young people, feel they are living in an open-air prison. They cannot leave. They cannot enter at will. They have no real livelihoods prospects if they are young, etc., etc. So hopelessness is what you feel at the same time as there is also more and more violence.
And Jan Egeland, I wanted to ask you specifically about the demolitions you mentioned. There have been 700 structures demolished by the Israeli authorities just since January of this year in the past 10 months, even though there is continued worldwide condemnation of Israel's attempt to seize more and more land of the Palestinians, but yet Israel has surfaced no consequences from its continued flouting of that condemnation.
You're absolutely right. Hundreds and hundreds of structures are houses. These are homes, really, are leveled. Many of them were built by Norwegian, Swedish, German, British aid money for very vulnerable people, Bedouins and single mother held households, etc. What the occupying power says is that they are just doing city planning, they're just doing city restructuring and so on. In effect, what you see is that there are more and more settlements, illegal settlements, which means that in violation of international law, you transfer your own population to colonize other land, and the population that lived there is being transferred. Today, I met with Fatima, 70 years old. She is here in occupied East Jerusalem. She's been living in the same house since she was born. Her father started to rent it in 1948 from the Jordanians. Today, in her backyard, there is a tent set up by the extremist right-wing politician called Itamar Ben-Gvir. He is the one who will be elected today on a potentially very large profile of extremist rightist parties under the rubric religious Zionism. He brings in settler youth from the illegal settlements on the West Bank. And I saw numerous films from footage from cameras of these settlers beating up Palestinians. They hurt this Fatima, 70-year-old. She was bleeding. Her two sons came to rescue her, and not the mafia, the violent settler youth were not arrested. Her sons were arrested because they were defending Fatima in her own house. You can't make up this kind of an injustice that is before our eyes here in occupied lands.
And you mentioned the conditions in Gaza. For those people who are not familiar with the life for the 2 million inhabitants of Gaza, could you talk about some of the worst atrocities occurring there?
Well, Gaza, of course, is not a place where there are Israeli soldiers anymore. They were withdrawn. But Gaza is under siege. The border is closed, shut, and you have to go through in enormous kinds of barriers, checkpoints, etc., controlled by Israel, to be able to enter. There are two, one from Egypt, one from Israel, entry points, and there is another one where trucks can come and go. Those places are often shut down. That's why we say there is a siege. The fishermen. And of course, there is a great dependency on aid now in Gaza. So people try to feed themselves by being fishermen. They've been doing that for thousands of years. They can go 3 miles into the ocean. If they go further, the fishermen, Israeli Navy would be arresting them or even sinking their boat. They cannot go by air to this area because Israel is controlling the air completely. This is siege. This is an open-air prison. Gaza, 2 million inhabitants, is two-thirds of the municipality of my hometown of Oslo in Norway.
So, Jan Egeland, in this year, 120 Palestinians have been killed so far, making it the deadliest year since 2015. For the first 2 weeks of October alone, 6 Palestinian children killed, bringing the death toll of children, those under the age of 18, to 28 this year. Can you talk about whether you see this changing with this election that's about to happen, but most importantly, how this will end? What is the Norwegian Refugee Council calling for?
Well, I mean, it may change to the worse by the election today, because the parties that are likely to make big progress are all parties who are against reconciliation with their own neighbors, the Palestinians, against a peace process, and in favor of illegal settlements, colonization of occupied land, and the displacement of Palestinian families from their ancestral land. So I think it could get worse, but I'm not giving up. I met with the group of European consul generals and ambassadors here in Jerusalem today. I think there is in Europe a great support for helping Palestinians in their hour of greatest need. On the Palestinian side, the political leadership are split. They are incoherent. There is a big divide between the West Bank and where held by the Palestinian Authority and Gaza, where it's Hamas and so on. So, of course, Palestinian side is weak. The stronger side is Israel, and there's one force that can really convince Israel to do what is in their interest, namely to make peace with their neighbors, and that's the United States. But the United States is nowhere to be seen as a political force for a peace process.
When President Biden met with the Israeli president, Isaac Herzog, at the White House last week, during public remarks, neither of them mentioned the Palestinians. Yet, Israel is one of the highest recipients of military aid in the world from the United States, receiving billions of dollars. Your message to President Biden, Jan Egeland, what this means?
Well, my message to the Biden administration is perhaps even reinforced by my message to the U.S. Congress. I mean, if you're friends of Israel, I'm a friend of Israel. I've known many Israeli prime ministers. I studied at the Hebrew University here. Been a friend of Israel for in my entire life. If you, the United States, would be a friend of Israel, tell them to not undermine their own security by enraging Palestinian youth beyond belief, by humiliating them, grabbing their land, making it possible them to have livelihoods in places like Gaza, and killing children 5 times more frequently than the total number of fatalities on the Israeli side of all ages, military and civilian. I mean, you can't make it up, the kind of an injustice that is before our eyes here. And that's not in Israel's interest, because they need to live in peace and security with their neighbors.
And Jan Egeland, I'd like to broaden the discussion. Last month, your organization, the Norwegian Refugee Council, was awarded the Hilton Humanitarian Prize, which is considered the world's largest annual award for a nonprofit. Congratulations, first of all. But I wanted to ask you, there are more people on the move, refugees, from their home countries across the world than ever before. What do you see as some of the areas that are deserving attention when it comes to refugees that are not getting the kind of attention among the media and the citizens of the advanced industrial countries?
Yeah, indeed, we have broken that ceiling that I didn't believe we would break. I hope we would never break in my lifetime, which is well over 100 million people now displaced by violence and conflict in the world. You go back 10 years, and it was 45 million. Now it's 110 million. The Ukraine war alone has displaced 14 million people, half of them refugees in the rest of Europe, half of them basically displaced within Ukraine. Ukraine is a horrific war. I'm going there on my third visit this year now after this, because Ukraine is getting a lot of attention and is also getting a lot of our assistance, and there are resources going there. In the shadow of that war, it got worse in Gaza and the West Bank, where I am now. It got much worse on the Horn of Africa, Somalia, where we will have a famine. We haven't had a famine now for decades. We'll probably have an epic biblical famine there. It's got worse in Syria, on both sides of the front lines, in Yemen, on both sides of the front lines, in the Congo, etc. So I'm nervous, really, for the world turning inwards, looking, becoming more U.S. is becoming more polarized, more inward-looking, more nationalistic. So are so many European countries. And we are, in a way, we, Norwegian Refugee Council and all of the other colleagues, left often a little bit alone in the front lines, where there are more people in need than ever before.
منك والله الله ما خلق ابيخ منك والله الله ما خلق ابيخ منك والله الله ما خلق ابيخ منك والله الله ما خلق مفكر حالك اشي وانت بلا اشي ابيخ منك والله الله ما خلق ابيخ منك والله عقلك صار عقلين دايما كلمتين حتى المطلق عندك صار مطلقين أبيخ منك والله الله ما خلق أبيخ منك والله الله ما خلق حتى بالسياسة عقلك في سؤاسي تسبح لي ببحر يافا وتقول ما أحلى إسرائيل أبيخ منك والله الله ما خلق أسقع منك والله الله ما خلق لغزة بتعمل لا على أقصى يلا يلا مصري الشوبينج بالمملة أزنخ منك والله الله ما خلق أزنخ منك والله الله ما خلق مفزلك شايف حالك وبطل تطبيع أبيخ منك والله الله ما خلق أكسل منك والله الله ما خلق أسكت ولا أحكي أصبر ولا أشكي حيرتني بهالمود بس للصبر حدود أصعب منك والله الله ما خلق أنطخ منك والله الله ما خلق
We begin today's show in Israel, where Benjamin Netanyahu is preparing to become prime minister again, 16 months after being ousted from office. Results from Tuesday's election show Netanyahu's Likud party and its far-right allies won 64 seats in the Knesset, enough votes to form a parliamentary majority. Netanyahu served as prime minister from 1996 to 99, and then again from 2009 to 2021. He's currently on trial for corruption. A key member of his government will likely be Itamar Ben-Gvir, an ultra-nationalist lawmaker who openly supports the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. In 2007, he was convicted of incitement to racism and supporting a terrorist organization. Ben-Gvir lives in an illegal settlement in the occupied West Bank. Last year, he relocated his parliamentary office to the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem, where settlers have attempted to violently evict Palestinian residents from their homes. For years, Itamar Ben-Gvir hung a picture in his home of Baruch Goldstein, an Israeli-American who killed 29 Palestinians at a mosque in Hebron in 1994. The Jerusalem Post's editor-in-chief described Ben-Gvir as, quote, the modern Israeli version of an American white supremacist and a European fascist, unquote. The return of Netanyahu comes as Israeli security forces killed four Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem Thursday, while Israeli fighter jets bombed Gaza. Israeli forces have killed at least 130 Palestinians in the West Bank this year. Many Palestinians fear the return of Netanyahu will only make things work. This is Yusuf Khattab, a resident of Gaza.
None of the governments that were formed by Benjamin Netanyahu in the previous year gave the Palestinian people their rights. He was even rejecting all agreements with the Palestinian Authority. This upcoming government is an extreme right government. As a result, the Palestinian people will not witness anything but war, destruction, killing, and more bloodshed, house demolitions, land uprooting, land confiscation, and the building of more settlements.
We're joined right now by Natasha Roth-Rowland. She's an editor and writer at 972 Magazine and a doctoral candidate in history at the University of Virginia. Her research and writing focuses on the Jewish far right in Israel, Palestine, and the United States. Natasha, welcome to Democracy Now! First of all, can you lay out the significance of this victory? And it's not only about Benjamin Netanyahu, but who he is allied with, the parties that will make up his coalition, and who they are.
Certainly. I mean, the first thing to say, really, is that the election results from Tuesday are very, very grim. If you were watching the polls leading up to the elections, it sort of looked like it might be a bit of a toss-up. It looked, at some points, as if Netanyahu's bloc might get 61 seats, which is a very, very razor-thin margin in a Knesset of 120 seats. Sometimes it looked as if the so-called anti-Netanyahu bloc would get 61 seats. He has now landed a 64-seat majority, which is stronger than I think most people were anticipating. And as you say, it's not just about Netanyahu himself returning to power, you know, accompanied by this litany of criminal charges, which may well be dispensed with if the incoming coalition gets its way with the judicial system. But it's also about Netanyahu's allies. Chief among those, as you mentioned, is Itamar Ben-Gvir. He is the head of the Otzma Yehudit party, which ran with religious Zionism in these elections. And they brought in an unprecedented haul of 14 seats. That is the third largest party in the Knesset. This is going to be a whole new level of power for the extreme right in the government. And the thing I'll add to that is I think there is an understandable impulse to say that no matter who is in power in the Israeli government, not much changes. The occupation continues. Violence and surveillance against Palestinians inside the Green Line continue. Bombardments of Gaza continue. Everything we've seen in the past year is a gruesome testament to that. But unfortunately, things can always get worse. And under what looks like the new government, they will get worse. The question is how much.
So tell us who Itamar Gvir is. In an October 1995 interview, he can be seen holding an ornament taken from Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's car by far-right Israeli activists during a protest against Rabin and the Oslo Accords.
People managed to get to this symbol from Rabin's car. The symbol is a symbol, and it symbolizes that just as we got this symbol, we can get to Rabin.
That was Itamar Ben-Gvir in October 1995, so that was actually decades ago. A short time later, November 4th, 1995, a Jewish extremist assassinated Yitzhak Rabin in Tel Aviv. Your comment, Natasha.
I mean, the first thing I want to make clear is that the assassin, Yigal Amir, was not part of the same youth movement that Itamar Ben-Gvir was, but they shared similar ideologies. Itamar Ben-Gvir at that time was a youth activist with the Kach movement. Kach was the extreme-right party founded by Meiricha Hanna, an American-born rabbi and ultranationalist who emigrated to Israel in the 1970s, formed this party, and after a few unsuccessful attempts, managed to get elected to the Knesset in 1984. His party was banned from running in 1988, ostensibly due to its racist and anti-democratic platform, but the charge to ban it was actually led by other far-right parties who worried that Kach was going to begin nibbling away at their voter base. Having said that, even though Kach was banned from running in elections, it stuck around as a political movement. It was outlawed in 1994 after the terror attack you mentioned by Baruch Goldstein, where he murdered 29 Palestinians at prayer in Hebron. But it has continued to have this kind of coterie of core activists, despite its banning as a terrorist organization in Israel-Palestine. So that was the context in which Itamar Ben-Gvir spoke to the media in that clip that we just saw. He has maintained his views in the intervening decades. He had this photograph of Goldstein on his living room wall for decades. He was finally convinced to take it down in 2020 by some of his partners who he was running in elections with. He has since recanted his earlier statements that he sees Goldstein as a hero and as a defender of the Jewish people. It's my view that those statements are not to be taken seriously. I think they fit in the same bucket as his supposed moderation of his views on Palestinians and any kind of liberal vision for what Israel-Palestine should look like. One of his own party activists was caught on camera admitting that his apparent moderation of his views was just a ploy to make sure that he did not get struck from being able to run for the Knesset. And that's who we have at the top of a faction, number two, Justin Bezalel Smotrich, who's the head of religious Zionism that Otzma Yehudit ran with. That's who we have coming into the Knesset as a potential kingmaker. The ministry that he is seeking and may well get is Minister of Public Security. That puts him in charge of the police, and the prospects for that, I think, are frightening.
So, although you say he recanted, I wanted to go back to a decade ago, July 2011. When Ben-Gvir told a reporter why he chose to put that photograph of Baruch Goldstein on the wall of his home.
He's a righteous man. He's a hero. This is a doctor who saved Jews throughout his life.
And so how much power does he have today? Talk about what this means, what Netanyahu has had in the past, and who he's with today, and also the fact that Itamar Ben-Gvir relocated his parliamentary office to the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem, where—and the significance of what that means.
Well, I'll say the relocation to Sheikh Jarrah was somewhat of a political stunt. Ben-Gvir has really followed in the footsteps of his mentor, Meiricha Hanna, which is, you know, being very—I should maybe say astute in figuring out where the hotspot of tension is at any given time in Israel-Palestine and descending on it. It wasn't a permanent relocation. It was sort of a desk with a banner above it, but it was intended to incite tensions and confrontations, and he was successful in doing so. Now, as a coalition partner to Netanyahu, I mean, it remains to be seen what aspects of his party's platform he is able to push forward. I think in terms of assisting Netanyahu, as I said before, the attacks on the judiciary, which are intended to get Netanyahu off the hook in his various corruption trials, I think is a very likely prospect. Ben-Gvir himself wants to encourage emigration—I'll put that in inverted commas—emigration of Palestinians from within Israel-Palestine on both sides of the Green Line. He wants to make it much easier for Israeli security forces to punish, I should say, Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line with minimal repercussions. There is already a great deal of impunity enjoyed by soldiers and police officers acting against Palestinians. He wants to make that impunity even broader. And he wants to, in his own words, crack down on Reform Jews. There were some easing of processes for conversion and so on regarding Reform Jews in Israel-Palestine over the past year. Those look set to be rolled back. His party also looks set to attack the LGBTQ community. They want to reverse the ban on so-called conversion therapy. And just yesterday, the head of the Noam Party, which is part of the religious Zionism slate that won 14 seats in this last election, said that he wants to try and legally ban pride parades. Hmm.
Back on that issue of Sheikh Jarrah, I wanted to play a clip of Ben-Gvir. This is just last month, waving a gun and shouting during a confrontation in this neighborhood.
If they, Palestinians, throw stones, shoot them.
He said, shoot them, he said. This is Mahmoud Saou, a Palestinian who lives in Sheikh Jarrah, describing Itamar Ben-Gvir's actions in his neighborhood.
This field office is within the plan to take over Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and the houses there. He sets up his tent here and starts pointing at houses that he wants to take. My house is under threat. My neighbor's house is also under threat. We all receive eviction orders or courts to increase in rent, also orders not to build or renovate. He used to come here and make trouble for everyone. Imagine a Knesset member pulling out his gun towards the people in the neighborhood. We have children and women here. So what do you expect from him if they assigned him as the Minister of Public Security or any ministerial position? Of course he will be more confident and relieved. But as my neighbor said, we don't care, even if he was a prime minister. We are staying in our houses here. This is our legitimate right to defend our houses and children.
So, Natasha Roth-Rowland, Haaretz ran an editorial titled, Kahanaism Won, Israel's Now Closing in on a Right-Wing Religious Authoritarian Revolution. So, explain also, overall, what this means. Lara Friedman, the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, tweeted Wednesday, reminder, 6 months before the Israeli election that made Kahanis arguably the most powerful political force in Israel, the Biden administration decided to do its part in normalizing Kahanism by removing Kahanis groups from U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations where they've been listed for decades, which also, by the way, goes to the conviction of Ben-Gvir for being part of a terrorist organization and for racism, if you could respond to all of that.
I mean, in terms of the what Lara Friedman tweeted about the State Department removing Kach and Kahana Chai from Kahana Chai, I'm sorry, is a sort of offshoot of Kach that emerged in the wake of Meir Kahana's assassination in 1990. I think what Lara Friedman is saying is absolutely correct, and I don't think it's the State Department alone that has played a role in this normalization that she discusses. I think it's certainly unhelpful that these two groups were removed from that designation 6 months ago, because I think that's contributed to this idea that Kahanism and Kach and Kahanist ideology are somehow relics of the past or sufficiently marginal that they don't monitor—they don't merit close monitoring and surveillance. And I think all of that is incorrect. I think it's also of a piece with a wider marginalization of Ben-Gvir and Kahanism that I think will unavoidably be revisited now, but that has played a big role in downplaying the threat posed by his ideology and its potential to win power in the Israeli government. I think if we want to put things into a little bit of a more familiar context for watchers here in the U.S., the effect has been a little bit like what happened with Trump during his rise to power before becoming elected president. There were these kind of parallel forces where he was dismissed and ridiculed as, you know, an extremist, but also a bit of a joke who never stood a chance of coming to power. But at the same time, he received such an intense media spotlight that he won the kind of coverage that most politicians, I think, can only dream of. The same thing happened with Ben-Gvir in Israel-Palestine. He was so long dismissed as, you know, an unpleasant, horrendous but marginal phenomenon. But the second that he got into the Knesset, he started being invited repeatedly onto Israeli news shows. There was a statistic from earlier this year that said within a given period, he was only second to Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in terms of airtime that he received on the Israeli media. So I think those two things have really combined to push him into this place where he has enjoyed greater exposure than ever, which rather than turning people off him has actually won supporters to him and his party. And all of the kind of marginalization and dismissal of the threat that he poses has actually backfired, because now he will be going into a governing coalition near the top of the third most powerful party in the coalition, and may well be very well be in charge of the police forces, as we said.
Well, Natasha Roth-Rowland, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Editor and writer at 972 Magazine, doctoral candidate in history at the University of Virginia. Her research focusing on the Jewish far right in Israel, Palestine, and the United States.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Montreal International Documentary Festival is celebrating its 25th edition, a unique opportunity to enjoy the best documentary films from all around the world.
This fall, the RIDM returns exclusively to theaters and venues with screenings, festivities, and much more.
See you from November 17th to the 27th.
Discover the full program at RIDM.ca.
The RIDM, where all stories meet.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKUT, 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro-V. Gonna be playing a whole bunch of sampled music today. Gonna get real busy on the turntables. Feel like getting into some old loops and letting people know kind of where it came from without saying anything, if you know what I mean. So, gonna be hearing some music from Dorothy Ashby, The Blackbirds, Aaron Neville, Bill Conti, The Charmels, Galt McDermott, Hamilton Bohannon, Ramsey Lewis, Dave Grusin, The Crusaders,